The CBS News Weekend Roundup, coming up next.
Need a website? Why not do it yourself with Wix.com? No matter what business you're in, Wix.com has something for you. Used by more than 84 million people worldwide, Wix.com makes it easy to get your website live today. You need to get the word out about your business. It all starts with a stunning website. With hundreds of designer-made, customizable templates to choose from, and the drag-and-drop editor, there is no coding needed. You don't need to be a programmer or designer to create something beautiful. You can do it yourself with Wix.com. Wix.com empowers business owners to create their own professional websites every day. When you're running your own business, you're bound to be busy. Too busy. Too busy worrying about your budget. Too busy scheduling appointments. Too busy to build a website for your business. And because you're too busy, it has to be easy. And that's where Wix.com comes in. With Wix.com, it's easy and free. Go to Wix.com to create your own website today. The result is stunning.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Election Day is 5 weeks from this coming Tuesday. Between now and then, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton will clash twice more in debates. We'll begin in a moment by reviewing debate number one. Trump says all the online polls show that he was the winner. People close to Clinton say, "You must be kidding." Also ahead, a fatal train crash in Hoboken, New Jersey. You'll hear CBS News reporter Matt Piper.
One person standing on the platform was killed. Most injuries, more than 100 of them, were on the train.
Automatic systems to apply brakes when it comes into a station, not yet installed. We'll report on that. Also, FBI Director James Comey predicts terrorists will try to come here from Iraq and Syria when they're defeated over there.
Sometime in the next 2 to 5 years, like we've never seen before.
Also on this Weekend Roundup, we'll report on funerals of Miami's star pitcher Jose Fernandez and Israel's former leader Shimon Peres. I'm Dan Raviv. Let's begin with the first clash of the titans. Hillary Clinton, with years of debating experience and not hiding the fact she huddled with advisors for days to prepare, versus Donald Trump, who never had a one-on-one political debate and boasted that he did not do much preparation. Our team coverage from the debate site at Hofstra University on Long Island, New York, begins with CBS News correspondent Stephen Portnoy.
It seemed to start politely.
Donald, it's good to be with you.
Secretary Clinton, yes. Is that okay? Good. I want you to be very happy.
But with that, pleasantries went out the window. Hillary Clinton threw the first punches, hitting Trump's tax plan.
I call it trumped up. Trickle down.
And she said Trump is hiding something in his taxes.
Maybe he's not as rich as he says he is.
Trump accused Clinton of not doing enough to stop jobs from leaving the country.
Well, you haven't done it in 30 years or 26 years.
Well,
I've been a senator. You
Donald,
haven't done it.
It was Clinton's husband who signed NAFTA, which Trump called one of the worst things that ever happened to American manufacturing.
You go to Ohio, Pennsylvania, you go anywhere you want, Secretary Clinton, and you will see devastation.
Clinton said Trump rooted for the housing crisis and stiffed contractors.
You wouldn't pay what the man needed to be paid, what he was charging you.
Maybe he didn't do a good job, and I was unsatisfied with his work.
Midway through, the debate seemed to turn with a focus on race.
This is Pam Coulter. It was one of the most heated exchanges of the debate. Donald Trump said he had developed a very good relationship with the African American community, but was unrepentant for his years of questioning President Obama's citizenship.
I think I did a great job and a great service, not only for the country, but even for the president, in getting him to produce his birth certificate.
Secretary Clinton.
Hillary Clinton said Trump used the racist lie to launch his political career and had been sued by the Justice Department for housing discrimination.
So he has a long record of engaging in racist behavior.
Trump accused her of treating then-Senator Obama with terrible disrespect during their 2008 debates.
When you try to act holier than thou, it really doesn't work.
As the debate turned to foreign policy, Clinton attacked Trump's temperament and his fitness to be commander-in-chief.
His cavalier attitude about nuclear weapons is so deeply troubling.
Trump's argument seemed to come down to this.
She's got experience, that I agree, but it's bad, bad experience.
Stephen Portnoy, CBS News, at the presidential debate in Hempstead, New York.
We're joined by CBS News senior political editor Steve Chigaris. In a horse race sense, Steve, who was helped and who was hurt by that first debate?
Well, it's an interesting question. So historically, we tend to say that the polling shows that there are no huge jumps in polling, and the results of the election don't usually hinge on the debates. However, this is a unique year. We have two candidates who have really high negatives. They're extremely disliked by the electorate. And so we're looking at those negatives and what were Trump's negatives going in. Temperament, big question. Coming out of that debate, I think there are still big questions about his temperament. He spent the week talking about Miss Universe and going back and forth on Twitter and with Hillary Clinton about something that happened 20 years ago in terms of his treatment of Miss Universe. So plays into the temperament question, something that came up during the debate. For Hillary Clinton, the question with her is honesty and transparency. She was asked about her emails, which plays into that. She didn't have a solid answer to that question. But all of this stuff with Trump has sort of overshadowed Hillary Clinton in that debate. And I think the talk post-debate is really negative for Trump.
Well, there were a lot of analysts who said it helped Clinton, but there are two more debates between these two candidates. And so that can change so much by November 8th. No one will remember debate number one.
There are opportunities for Trump to turn this around. The second debate is a town hall style debate. Not only will he be taking questions from two moderators, but he'll be taking questions from the audience as well. So we'll see how he handles that. We'll see what the dynamic is in that situation.
That does change things. What's the word on whether he is getting a lot of advice to be better prepared this time? I mean, he has told us, thanks to Twitter, don't believe any sources in my campaign. There are no sources. They're all made up. But what do we think about that notion that he'll prepare more this time?
Yeah, the whole preparation question around Trump is very interesting. I think they were trying to lower expectations going into the first debate, suggesting he wasn't being prepared. But actually, it seemed like he was being prepared. If you listen very closely to the beginning of that debate, there were some canned lines that he used over and over again, referring to politicians like Secretary Clinton and trying to make the point that he's an agent of change. That comes from preparation.
But that's hard to keep up for 90 minutes, and he didn't.
That's right. And she, as a skilled debater, would lay traps for him that he fell right into. And I think as you saw the debate going through the evening, he was not keeping up with the strategy of a debate. And I think that's hard to prepare for somebody who has never really debated one-on-one with another political candidate.
People close to Clinton said they feel better after the debate, in part with some polling results, that she's doing a little better or her decline has stopped. Is that about it?
Well, there's two things we're seeing in the polls. One, that she, among voters, was the clear winner of the debate. And so, of course, that makes them feel very good about what happened on Monday night. And what we're seeing also in terms of the horse race numbers, it seems as if she's stemming the bleeding a bit. For the last few weeks, Donald Trump has been closing the polls. He's been tightening in battleground states and some states taking a bit of a lead. And now we're seeing indications that that has been stemmed a bit. So we'll see if this has actually been a bounce for her or if she is stopping the bleeding. We'll see how it goes.
This coming Tuesday at a college campus in Virginia, there's a debate between the two running mates, Tim Kaine, the Democrat, Mike Pence, the Republican. I'm not convinced there's much importance to this debate. Steve, what do you think?
These are two people who have been completely overshadowed by Trump and Clinton. That is the main event in this campaign, the top of the ticket, more so than ever. And we are dealing with two older candidates, two of the oldest nominees we've seen at the presidential level. And there are questions about, are these two vice presidential candidates ready to step in? I think you'll be hearing a lot about that, their readiness to step in if something happens at the top of the ticket.
Steve Chigaris, thanks very much.
Thanks, Dan.
We'll have a lot more on the debate and the debate still to come. But first, we'll cover other news, including the train crash in New Jersey and the teenager in South Carolina charged with murdering his father, then shooting two little kids. Plus other stories on the CBS News Weekend Roundup. On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Dan Revive. Standing on a platform at a commuter train station, a woman was killed by debris from a train that crashed into the station, apparently at high speed. That was in Hoboken, New Jersey. Many New York City area workers travel that route. CBS's Matt Piper reports.
It will be up to investigators to determine what went wrong when a New Jersey Transit train carrying more than 200 people crashed into the Hoboken train station. But those on the train say they knew something wasn't right just before impact during the morning rush.
I looked outside the window as we were approaching the station, and I noticed that we weren't slowing down. So I knew something was wrong. I just didn't know what.
I observed them coming at a high rate of speed.
One person standing on the platform was killed. Most injuries, more than 100 of them, were on the train. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo says the numbers could have been worse.
The silver lining is that there was only one fatality really was a blessing.
Matt Piper, CBS News, Hoboken, New Jersey.
Why didn't the train slow down automatically with a braking system that the railway industry calls positive train control? New Jersey Transit doesn't use it. CBS News transportation correspondent Chris Van Cleve reports.
Investigators will try to determine if positive train control could have prevented the speeding New Jersey Transit train from smashing into the Hoboken station. The technology relies on GPS satellites, radio towers, and ground sensors to monitor a train's speed and location. If it detects a train is going too fast or being operated unsafely, onboard computers will kick in to slow it or stop it. Nationwide, PTC is available on just 29% of passenger locomotives and 22% of passenger track miles. As of last May, commuter railroads have spent nearly $1 billion installing the pricey technology. New Jersey Senator Cory Booker is frustrated by the slow progress.
We don't need any more warnings. We don't need any more accidents. It's a matter of getting it done.
That from CBS's Chris Van Cleve. Now in El Cajon, California, near San Diego, an all-too-familiar trigger for protests in the streets. A black man who turned out to be unarmed was shot dead by a white police officer.
We need to know what's going on. Why are they killing black men out here?
The man who's dead, Alfred Olongo, age 38, was a refugee from Uganda who came to the U.S. at age 13. Federal authorities had been trying to deport him after charges of drug dealing and gun possession. Tuesday night, CBS's Maria Villarreal reported.
You killed my brother in front of me!
Video taken moments after the shooting shows a distraught woman who's identified as the man's sister.
Oh my God, you killed my brother!
She says she called police for help and told them her brother was mentally ill and unarmed.
The male rapidly drew an object from his front pants pocket, placed both hands together on it, and extended it rapidly towards the officer, taking what appeared to be a shooting stance.
One officer discharged a taser while simultaneously another opened fire. Police haven't said what the object the man pulled out was, but they now know it wasn't a gun.
That in Southern California in El Cajon. In South Carolina on Wednesday, police say a 14-year-old shot two younger kids and a teacher outside an elementary school. One of the kids, a 6-year-old, was critically wounded with brain injury from loss of blood. And the shooter is also charged in juvenile court with murdering his father earlier that morning. That was in Townville. It's 100 miles northeast of Atlanta. CBS's Manuel Bajorquez on the scene.
Dozens of law enforcement officers began swarming Townville Elementary School 7 minutes after receiving a call that there was a gunman on campus.
The shooter's going to be a white male, all black coat and clothing and blonde hair.
2 6-year-old students were shot, one in the leg, the other in the foot. A female teacher was also struck in the shoulder.
The shooter is a juvenile. He's a white male. There's no racial undertones there. There's no terrorism involved.
Police say the shooter, who was armed with a handgun, never entered the school. Volunteer firefighter Jamie Brock apprehended him and held him outside on the playground until police arrived.
And as y'all have heard, one of our firefighters did that and probably saved a lot more lives.
The FBI Director James Comey says hackers, perhaps foreigners, for some reason have been getting into the voter registration records of several states. CBS's Jeff Pegues reports.
First it was Arizona and Illinois. Now multiple law enforcement sources are telling CBS News that a total of about 10 states have had their systems probed or breached by hackers. We learned that information as government officials are becoming increasingly concerned about Russian efforts to disrupt or influence the election.
We are urging the states just to make sure that their deadbolts are thrown and their locks are on.
On Wednesday on Capitol Hill, lawmakers questioned FBI Director James Comey about whether the Russians were trying to breach U.S. election systems.
There have been a variety of scanning activities, as well as some attempted intrusions at voter registration databases beyond those we knew about in July and August.
Officials have been reluctant to blame Russia publicly, but privately, cyber experts and government officials alike believe the Russian government or hackers working with it are behind the election system cyber attacks. And this brings hack on the Democratic National Committee. In an interview earlier this month, Russian President Vladimir Putin played coy when asked about his government's involvement in the DNC hack.
No, I don't know anything about that.
A government official says the Russians like their cyber activity to grab headlines. And while these cyber strikes have been successful in accomplishing that goal, U.S. officials are confident that the outcome of the election will not be affected. While voter databases are accessible through the internet, most voting machines are not.
FBI Director Comey also told Congress something that may not be getting enough attention. If ISIS is defeated in Syria and Iraq, a lot of terrorists are likely to try to enter Western countries, including the U.S.
They will not all die on the battlefield in Syria and Iraq. There will be a terrorist diaspora sometime in the next 2 to 5 years, like we've never seen before.
Now, in the battle against ISIS, the U.S. military claims some successes. Dozens of top men in the terrorist group killed by coalition air raids in Iraq and Syria. But in Syria, the crisis, violence, and confusion only get worse. Ceasefire efforts by the U.S. and Russia for the city of Aleppo broke down. Secretary of State John Kerry blamed stepped-up attacks by Russia's air force in support of Syria's dictatorial government.
I think we're on the verge of suspending the discussion because it's irrational in the context of the kind of bombing taking place. There's no notion or indication of a seriousness of purpose.
It was 1 year ago that Russia intervened on the side of Syria's government. A reporter in Beirut, Ahmed Bayram, told us that Russian air raids have destroyed a hospital in Aleppo. On one night, 20 civilians were killed, hundreds of thousands said to be stuck, unable to leave or get relief supplies.
Quarter of a million people stuck in that area, where Russian warplanes have been constantly shelling, and there's no sign of abating. It's safe to say that this is the worst in 5 years of war.
Stay with us, please. We'll analyze the Trump-Clinton debate and report on the shocking death of a Miami Marlins pitcher. Also, the passing of Israeli leader Shimon Peres. Presidents Obama and Bill Clinton were in Israel at the funeral. All that and more on the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
It's finally fall. The weather is cooling off, and there's no better time to upgrade your cookouts than right now. Let me tell you about Omaha Steaks. They have a huge menu of steaks and more. The process is convenient and quick, shopping delivered straight to your door. Every purchase is backed by Omaha Steaks' 100% unconditional guarantee. And right now, you can get the limited-time family grill pack for just $49.99. You get all of this. 2 5-ounce filet mignons, 2 5-ounce top sirloins, 4 4-ounce boneless pork chops, 4 3.5-ounce chicken fried steaks, 12-ounce package of all beef meatballs, 4 4-ounce Omaha steak burgers, 4 4-ounce gourmet jumbo franks, a 16-ounce package of Omaha steakhouse fries, 4 caramel apple tartlets, OS seasoning packet, plus 4 additional Omaha steaks burgers. Just for listening, Omaha Steaks is offering all of this for only $49.99. This is a huge savings. Go to omahasteaks.com, enter code FTN in the search bar, and add the family grill pack to your cart. Don't miss this deal. Visit omahasteaks.com and enter code FTN in the search bar to get over 30 gourmet items for just $49.99.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Dan Revive. We have more to report and review about the first debate this past Monday between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. Their next debate is next weekend, Sunday, October 9th, and they have a final one on Wednesday, October 19th. Here's how CBS News correspondent Major Garrett summarized the debate hours after it ended at Hofstra University in Hempstead, New York.
Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton wasted little time clashing over who is physically fit to serve as president.
She doesn't have the look. She doesn't have the stamina.
As soon as he travels to 112 countries and negotiates a peace deal, or even spends 11 hours testifying in front of a congressional committee, he can talk to me about stamina.
The world, let me tell you.
Asked why he won't release his tax returns, Trump deflected by raising the scandal that's dogged Clinton for months.
I will release my tax returns against my lawyer's wishes when she releases her 33,000 emails that have been deleted. As soon as she releases them, I will release.
Clinton suggested Trump was hiding something and said he may have paid no federal income tax at all.
That makes
me
smart.
If he's paid zero, that means zero for troops, zero for vets, zero for schools or health.
Trump, who interrupted Clinton with little remarks like not true dozens of times, said later there was something wrong with his microphone. The debates, he said, are rigged against him. On Friday, the debate commission confirmed there were, quote, issues regarding Donald Trump's audio that affected the sound level in the debate hall, meaning the audience of 1,000 did not always hear him well. Everyone in politics was talking about the early morning messages on Twitter on Friday by Donald Trump about a former Miss Universe from Venezuela, CBS's Stephen Portnoy reports.
Donald Trump was up in the pre-dawn hours tweeting about his 20-year-old feud with Alicia Machado. The former Miss Universe says Trump called her Miss Piggy after she put on some weight. Here was the pair in 1997 on CBS This Morning.
She had a little problem during the middle where she gained a little weight.
I don't think so.
Yeah, she's probably right.
I don't think so.
Okay.
In a 5 a.m. tweet, Trump called Machado disgusting, urging Americans to check out her sex tape. Hillary Clinton's camp tweets, "What kind of man stays up all night to smear a woman with lies and conspiracy theories?"
Hillary Clinton made a point of phoning Machado on Friday, publicly praising her. As for Trump, he tweeted, "If you're knocking him for being on Twitter at 3 a.m., quote, at least you know I will be there awake to answer the call." Trump says his supporters will stop buying USA Today after that newspaper, which never endorsed any candidate for president, declared that Trump is unfit. CBS's Nancy Cordes has more.
In an 8-point takedown, the editorial board called Trump a dangerous demagogue who is ill-equipped to be commander-in-chief and a serial liar who traffics in prejudice. On Clinton, the board split, with some expressing reservations about her, quote, sense of entitlement, her lack of candor, and her extreme carelessness.
Trump suggests he might, on Sunday, October 9th, talk about Bill Clinton's infidelities and how Hillary Clinton smeared the alleged mistresses. Secretary Clinton says Trump can run his campaign any way he wants to, adding,
"Isn't this one of the strangest elections you've ever seen?"
A reminder on many of our CBS News radio stations this coming Tuesday at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, the debate between the running mates, Senator Tim Kaine, the Democrat, and Governor Mike Pence, the Republican. The moderator will be my CBS News colleague, Elaine Quijano. Now to very sad news from Miami. In a boating accident last weekend, Marlins star Jose Fernandez was killed with two friends. At age 24, Fernandez was one of the very best pitchers in Major League Baseball, a defector from Cuba who made it big but died too young.
I'm Peter King. His friends have remembered Jose Fernandez as someone who loved his family, baseball, Miami, people, and something else that ultimately ended his life, his agent Scott Boras.
He loved the water. He loved his boat. They were the vehicle to his freedom.
Marlins owner Jeffrey Loria says the young man who escaped from Cuba loved his new country, too.
He worked so hard to experience the American dream and ended up being its very embodiment.
Fittingly, the music for the recessional was this. Peter King, CBS News, Orlando.
In Israel, a state funeral for Shimon Peres. He died at age 93. Until he suffered a stroke recently, he'd been a vibrant campaigner for Middle East peace. As prime minister and in other government posts, Peres built up Israel's military strength, took credit for creating the country's secret nuclear weapons program, but above all, he wanted reconciliation with the Palestinians. At the funeral in Jerusalem on Friday, former President Bill Clinton.
His critics often claimed he was a naive, overly optimistic dreamer. They were only wrong about the naive part. He knew exactly what he was doing in being overly optimistic.
And Barack Obama spoke at the Peres funeral, devoting about 30 hours to fly to Israel, attend the ceremony and the burial, shake hands with Israeli and Palestinian leaders, and fly home to Washington to underline that Mr. Obama wants Israel to focus on making peace. Here's part of his eulogy.
Shimon's story, the story of Israel, the experience of the Jewish people, I believe it is universal. It's the story of a people who, over so many centuries in the wilderness, never gave up on that basic human longing to return home. It's the story of a people who suffered the boot of oppression and the shutting of the gas chamber's door and yet never gave up on a belief in goodness. And it's the story of a man who was counted on and then often counted out again and again, and who never lost hope. Shimon Peres reminds us that the state of Israel, like the United States of America, was not built by cynics. We exist because people before us refused to be constrained by the past or the difficulties of the present. And Shimon Peres was never cynical. It is that faith, that optimism, that belief, even when all the evidence is to the contrary, that tomorrow can be better, that makes us not just honor Shimon Peres, but love him. The last of the founding generation is now gone. Shimon accomplished enough things in his life for 1,000 men. But he understood that it is better to live to the very end of his time on earth with a longing not for the past, but for the dreams that have not yet come true. An Israel that is secure in a just and lasting peace with its neighbors. And so now this work is in the hand of Israel's next generation. In the hands of Israel's next generation and its friends.
President Obama also said a few words in Hebrew.
Shimon.
Shimon.
Toda rabba.
Thank you very much.
Haver.
Dear friend.
Yakar.
Please follow us on Twitter for headlines at CBS Radio News. And I'm at Dan Raviv on the CBS News Weekend Roundup. On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, that's Bruce Springsteen, of course, and I'm Dan Raviv. The hit song in the 1970s, Born to Run, is also the title of Springsteen's autobiography, a memoir at age 67 published by a division of CBS, Simon & Schuster. CBS News correspondent Anthony Mason interviewed the boss, Springsteen, about this memoir.
So, this was your old hood?
Yeah. I knew everybody in every house on this street.
Bruce Springsteen's musical aspirations took root here in Freehold, New Jersey.
And how old were you when you were in your first band?
15.
His passion was apparent early.
You were very disciplined about what you were going after.
I wanted to be great. You know, that was all that mattered to me, was how good can I get?
Right.
And I was ready to sacrifice everything else to find out.
Speaking at the recording studio on his New Jersey farm, Springsteen said there was a ruthlessness to his ambition.
I needed to express myself as a musician. You know, it was so caught up with my identity, my sense of self-respect. It was primal and was a very unforgiving force.
Unforgiving. In what sense?
I was just going to run through whatever I had to run through, you know. Mm-hmm. And if you couldn't keep up with me, you were, you know, gone along the wayside.
My voice was never going to win any prizes, he writes, in Born to Run, his new autobiography. So that left the songs. The songs would be my fireworks. Springsteen had another underrated talent.
I was an excellent band leader. Very rare skill. Not a lot of good band leaders. It's a lost art.
What makes a good band leader?
Prince, phenomenal band leader. James Brown, of course, the ultimate band leader.
What's the skill, though, that you need to have?
The skill is the band has to be at your fingertips so that if you go like this, they move. You got to know how to arrange an entire show.
On the tour he just wrapped up, Springsteen routinely played for 4 hours a night. But 3 years ago, he felt the mileage catching up with him.
Every tour was, my arm was weakening. Finally, it got to a point where I realized, towards the end of the night, it was just difficult to play.
The cause, a damaged disc in his neck, so he underwent surgery.
They cut your throat, they take your vocal cords, they tie them off to one side. Guy gets in there with some titanium and some little tools, and they build you some new discs. They seal you back up again. It takes about 3 months before you can sing. That's the nerve-wracking part, you know?
More worrying for Springsteen was the attack of depression that hit him in his early 60s.
Do you see it coming? Do you feel it coming?
Not really, you know. It sneaks up on you. During the day, I couldn't find a comfortable place to sit or to stand or I couldn't find any place to be. You know, you just don't like being. It's fraught with too much confusion and despair, and you got a lot of bad thoughts, and it lasted for a long time. My 60s would last for a year, and then it would slip away, then it would come back for a year and a half.
Springsteen says therapy and antidepressants gave him his life back.
You know, it's certainly not funny when it's happening, but I go back and, you know, now it's like I'm talking about somebody else. It's like I'm not even talking about myself.
Bruce Springsteen speaking about his book, Born to Run, with CBS's Anthony Mason. Now, we turn to Anderson Cooper on assignment for 60 Minutes on CBS this Sunday evening. Your subject, Anderson, is Nate Parker, the actor who's now a movie director. His film, The Birth of a Nation, opens in a few days with a lot of advance praise. The themes include racism, slavery, and violence. Anderson Parker's now facing heavy controversy. What's that about?
This film, when it premiered at the Sundance Film Festival in January, it won some of the top prizes there. Audiences gave it standing ovations. It was bought by a major studio in Hollywood for $17.5 million, which was more than any independent film has ever been bought at Sundance for. So there was a lot of hype and buzz around the movie, talk of Oscar nominations potentially. But just in the last several months, as Nate Parker has been out promoting the film, and basically an episode from his past has started to make headlines. When he was 19 years old, he was a student wrestler at Penn State University, and he and his roommate were accused of raping a fellow student. And she made the accusation. She went to police, and they arrested Nate Parker and his roommate, put them on trial, and Nate was found not guilty. His roommate, Gene Celestin, was convicted of a lesser count of sexual assault. That conviction was later overturned, and his criminal record was expunged. But in the run-up to the film, there's been a kind of a re-examination of the trial, of the case. Certainly, you know, a lot of discussion about the issues of rape on college campuses, of sexual assault against women. And then Variety discovered and reported in mid-August that the woman who had accused Nate Parker and his roommate dropped out of Penn State after the trial, suffered years of psychological and emotional problems, and ended up killing herself in 2012. And that really is what created the latest round of controversy, people kind of looking back at exactly what Nate Parker and his roommate did with this woman, the accusations that were made against him back then, and how the trial itself played out.
And when he's done publicity for The Birth of a Nation, the story of a slave rebellion in Virginia in 1831, Nate Parker obviously has hated being asked about the rape allegation, and you asked him if he has anything to apologize for.
You know, he hasn't given really on-camera interviews about this. The film was also shown at the Toronto Film Festival recently. He didn't answer questions about it there. He had given a number of early statements, which some critics believed were sort of self-centered and lacked empathy. He points out he was not aware that the woman accuser had killed herself until Variety reported it. And so really, this is the first television interview he's given since he's learned that the woman had killed herself and in the run-up to the film. And I do. I ask him point blank if he feels he should apologize to the woman, to the woman's family. I ask him about, does he feel any guilt about anything that happened that night? We certainly re-examine the case and try to get him to respond as much as possible about the controversy, the headlines, and the way he views what happened back then through the prism of a 36-year-old man today.
The report's on 60 Minutes this Sunday. It's about Nate Parker, the filmmaker. That is Anderson Cooper on assignment for 60 Minutes. Anderson, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. We'll get back to news, including what did Congress accomplish before taking another break for the election? Also, the importance of getting a flu shot on the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
Are you hiring? Do you know where to post your job to find the best candidates? Posting your job in just one place isn't enough to find quality candidates. If you want to find the perfect hire, you need to post your job on all the top job sites, and now you can. With ZipRecruiter.com, you can post your job to 100-plus job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with one single click. Find candidates in any city or industry nationwide. Just post once and watch your qualified candidates roll into ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. No more juggling emails or calls to your office. You can quickly screen candidates, rate them, and hire the right person fast. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by over 800,000 businesses. And right now, listeners of the show can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/free trial. That's ZipRecruiter.com/free trial. One more time so you can try it for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/free trial.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Dan Revive. For the first time, a veto cast by President Obama was overridden by Congress. What's required is at least a two-thirds vote in both the Senate and the House, and then the president's veto is ignored. The bill, which is now law, was called JASTA, the Justice Against Sponsors of Terrorism Act, allowing American citizens to sue foreign governments related to cases of terrorism. Families of 9/11 victims believe that Saudi Arabia helped the hijackers who became mass murderers on 9/11 15 years ago. More from CBS News correspondent Margaret Brennan.
The White House called this the most embarrassing thing that the Senate has done in decades. But for the 9/11 families, this was a victory long overdue.
The bill is passed. The objections of the president to the contrary notwithstanding.
In a sweeping rebuke, Congress overrode President Obama's veto and gave the families of those killed on September 11th the legal right to sue Saudi Arabia for any alleged assistance to the terrorists. 15 of the 19 hijackers were Saudi-born. For Brett Eagleson, who lost his father in the World Trade Center attacks, the victory was bittersweet.
I haven't really been able to do anything in order to honor my dad, and helping get this passed into law, I feel like would make him really proud.
But on CNN Wednesday, the president said emotional appeals are what convinced Congress to enact a misguided law.
I wish Congress here had done what's hard. I didn't expect it, because if you're perceived as voting against 9/11 families right before an election, not surprisingly, that's a hard vote for people to take.
President Obama saying it would make America's own troops, diplomats, and businesses vulnerable to similar lawsuits. As the law took effect Wednesday, the CIA warned it could also damage U.S. collaboration with Saudi Arabia on counterterrorism and drive the kingdom to withdraw financial assets from the U.S. Even some of the senators who voted to enact the law said they'd now consider amending it. Maryland Senator Ben Cardin
said, look, we're going to keep a very close eye on this. It may be necessary for additional congressional action.
Brett Eagleson says there's no second guessing the outcome.
I think it brings us a step closer. Without this law, we'd never be able to discover the truth behind 9/11.
Now, many of the 9/11 families believe that U.S. courts may discover links between the Saudi government and the attackers. But for the past 15 years, the CIA has consistently said they have no evidence of any official ties.
That from correspondent Margaret Brennan at the White House. Let's turn to CBS News correspondent Stephen Portnoy at the Capitol. So that became law, and Saudi Arabia's government says it may have disastrous consequences, whatever that means. Some members of Congress, Stephen, are thinking perhaps of softening that legislation?
A sense of buyer's remorse starting to emerge here on Capitol Hill, Dan. Just one day after Congress enacted the bill into law over the president's objections, we started to hear Republican leaders commit to revisiting the issue. When Congress comes back in mid-November, they seem to be echoing the concerns of the White House that perhaps other countries could retaliate against the U.S. and take American officials and put them into their foreign courts.
Now, you've mentioned Congress is out till November 15th, after Election Day. Let's think about this past month. In September, some things had to be approved by Congress. Did the necessary items get done?
The very least that Congress could do is keep the government from shutting down, and that's what they have done. extending government funding for 10 more weeks. But significantly, Congress has also reached agreement on Zika funding and on flood relief, and Democrats got a commitment from Republican leaders to address the lead crisis in Flint, Michigan. That will be dealt with, we're told, in the lame duck session after mid-November.
And just to be clear about keeping the government open, there is no full year budget for the year that begins October 1st.
No, we have about 10 weeks through December 9th of funding, and then Congress will have to come back and figure out what to do next.
At the Capitol, that's CBS News congressional correspondent Stephen Portnoy. Thanks, Stephen.
You bet, Dan.
The head of one of America's big banks, Wells Fargo, faced hours of blistering questions just over a week ago in a Senate committee. Then this past Thursday in the House Financial Services Committee, John Stumpf heard members of Congress demand that he resign because Wells Fargo employees opened 2 million bank accounts and credit cards using the names and social security numbers of customers who did not know in order to meet sales targets. Sued by Los Angeles, then also by federal regulators, the bank is paying $185 million in penalties. Stumpf is trying to keep his job.
I'm very sorry that we broke trust with our customers, the American people. I am deeply sorry for that. I'm doing everything I can to repair that.
Stumpf did fire more than 5,000 Wells Fargo employees. He and other executives have given up millions of dollars worth of stock options.
We should have done more sooner, but we will not stop working until we get this right.
The attacks on the head of the bank were bipartisan. Republicans also criticized federal agencies for not detecting this fraud earlier. Now flu season, it's coming, so the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention tells us it's now time to get the latest influenza shot. CBS's Barry Bagnato has more.
CDC Director Dr. Tom Frieden urges Americans to get flu vaccinations, anyone over 6 months of age. Last year, fewer than half did.
If we could increase vaccination coverage by just 5%, that would prevent about 800,000 illnesses and nearly 10,000 hospitalizations.
Health officials are concerned, though, vaccinations could decline because the flu nasal spray is no longer recommended. You have to get a shot. Barry Bagnato, CBS News, Washington.
Let's go to France. Jeff Gilbert of CBS radio station WWJ Detroit flew to Paris for the auto show.
Electricity and autonomy are the big buzzwords here at the Paris Auto Show. Gartner analyst Mike Ramsey says the issues involving deployment of self-driving cars are more complex here in Europe.
In the United States, that's an issue with states. But you can imagine how that would be complicated further in different countries with different languages and different rules on the road.
There are a lot of electric vehicles at this show, as well as hybrids, as European countries tighten their air pollution rules. Jeff Gilbert, CBS News, Paris.
We end this broadcast with a Forbes magazine list of highest paid comedians. Vicky Barker has that.
Wine is supposedly now a health benefit.
Jerry Seinfeld's made more than $900 million in the past decade.
It cleans out the arteries. You can actually live longer, which I guess is good news unless you're a wino.
But he's lost the top spot in this year's best paid list to...
You see my fire? You see my fire?
Kevin Hart, who earns $87 million a year to Seinfeld's $43 million. The highest paid woman on the list...
Amy Schumer!
Fourth place Amy Schumer took home $17 million. Vicky Barker, CBS News.
Thanks for being with us. And anytime you want to hear more, do an internet search for CBS Weekend Roundup. You'll find our podcasts. Also, download our app for your smartphone. The free app is CBS Radio News. For those celebrating the Jewish New Year, have a happy start to the Lunar 5777. Everybody, please tune in Tuesday night, 9 p.m. Eastern Time, for our coverage of the vice presidential candidates debate. The Weekend Roundup is produced by Howard Arenstein at CBS News Washington. I'm Dan Revive. Have a great week.